Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the court. We have one case today. However, I'm pleased to announce that we first have a bar admission ceremony. At this time, the court recognizes the clerk of the court, Mr. Squires, for a motion.
May it please the court, I move the admission of Vincenzo Chiarello of the Commonwealth of Virginia, Hannah James of the District of Columbia, John Paul Kolnick V of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, Cooper C. Milhouse of the District of Columbia, Robert Paul Monahan of the District of Columbia, Vincent A. Mazzaro of the District of Columbia, Justin Daniel Loscalzo of the State of Maryland, Kevin Thomas O'Connor Jr. of the State of Alabama, and Stephen Elliott Paul of the District of Columbia. I have examined their credentials on file in the office of the clerk, and I am satisfied they possess the qualifications for membership in the bar of this court.
Counsel, my colleagues and I have conferred, and I'm pleased to announce that we have voted unanimously to accept you into the bar of this court. Therefore, Mr. Squires, your motion is granted. Please administer the oath.
Thank you. You'll stand. Do you solemnly swear or affirm that you will support the Constitution of the United States and that you will conduct yourselves as attorneys and counselors of this court uprightly and according to law, so help you God?
Counsel, I would like to welcome you to the bar of this court. And I think on this occasion, it's appropriate for me to recite some of the aspirational words of the law school that Mr. Paul and I attended, and which Judge Johnson received her LLM at the University of Virginia. And those words are that those alone may be servants of the law who labor with learning, courage, and devotion to preserve liberty and promote justice. Because we judges are convinced that you exemplify those ideals, it is a pleasure indeed to welcome you as members of the bar. So congratulations, and you may be seated. And thank you, Mr. Squires. We will now proceed with the case of United States versus Cunningham. Major Nelson, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant? And Major Christie, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government? Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court. May it please the court. I'm Major Spencer Nelson, along with my co-counsel, Major David Bosner. We represent the appellant, Senior Airman James Cunningham. The content of the impermissible victim impact presentation in this case had everything this court prohibited in United States versus Edwards and more. The government cannot meet its burden to show harmlessness because the quantity and the quality exceeded that of Edwards. Anybody listening to that PowerPoint presentation would have had their heartstrings ripped out, including the military judge who said, "To me, that's proper victim impact." It was not only emotionally heartrending, it was an invocation of the sacred, of the angels around the throne of heaven, singing hallelujah. Because of that, and because of the arguments that trial counsel made, knowing that they were improper, this court cannot be convinced Senior Airman Cunningham was sentenced on the basis of the evidence alone.
As you're aware, Judge Sparks and I dissented in that case in terms of prejudice.
Yes, Your Honor.
In your view, would our position have been strengthened or weakened if there had been a military judge alone trial as compared to the panel that actually sat in the Edwards case?
Your Honor, I think that would have been a neutral factor because both in this case and Edwards, the emotional impact of these presentations is so high that it can affect anyone, even a military judge sitting alone. And that's especially the case here, where the military judge said, "I'll consider it. I think it's proper." And there are several reasons why in this case the PowerPoint is not cumulative to what was entered into evidence. So for example, in United States versus Edwards, there were six witnesses who testified. In this case, there were only two. So the risk of cumulativeness in Edwards was much greater than it is here. And of those two witnesses who testified, there are several individual things in the PowerPoint presentation that they did not address. So, for example, they didn't talk about the somber melody of the music. They didn't talk about the spiritual lyrics of the music. They didn't mention the 13 videos that were embedded into the PowerPoint presentation. They didn't talk about the stock photos that were embedded. And that's in addition to the fact that the PowerPoint itself was not cumulative. It allowed all the transition, it allowed all the editing, it allowed all the effects. And then on top of that, you have very specific themes of religion. You have these images of angels in heaven, you have an image of a re-encounter in heaven, and then you have these religious exclamations of hallelujah, or in other words, praise the Lord. So those witnesses did not talk about that, but more importantly is the cumulative effect this had on the court-martial. So the music, in addition to the videos, that created an effect that was much greater than the evidence that was presented in sentencing or even findings. It turned the court-martial into something more akin to a funeral. It was much more somber, much more emotional than the testimony.
Now, you say having the military judge sit alone is a neutral factor as compared to how the panel. How does that square with our precedent?
Your Honor, it squares very nicely with the precedent. My understanding of the precedent says that this court can presume a military judge knows the law absent clear evidence to the contrary. And here there is clear evidence to the contrary. So the first is...
So what is that evidence?
Yeah, the first is the military judge, despite the plain language of RCM 1001, he let the PowerPoint into evidence in the first place. So this court should not presume he knows the law. And then the second, as I...
But if that were the case, we have these cases come when a military judge has made an error of admitting the evidence. You seem to be implying that the mere fact of them allowing in that evidence improperly means that there is no longer this presumption that they're not going to be biased or swayed or that they knew the law.
Your Honor, I think that would go to, you can't presume they knew the law. As to whether they would be persuaded by it, I would point to, number one, he said he would consider it, and he said it was proper. So just like this court focused on in Edwards of the impact statement in that case going back with the members and the members potentially looking at it, here, there's evidence that he watched it before, he watched it during, and presumably he had it with him. So the government can't meet its burden to show that he was immune from the effects of emotion.
Now, when you say he indicated he would consider it, didn't he indicate, well, I'll give it the weight that is appropriate or I'll consider the appropriate parts?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
So why shouldn't we assume that he did, in fact, consider those parts that were appropriate or put it in the proper context in terms of his decision-making process?
Your Honor, I think it goes to his words. He said he would give it weight as opposed to saying, I won't give it any weight because it's improper. So we know he at least gave it some weight by his words.
But the whole thing wasn't improper, was it?
Your Honor,
from start to finish?
The whole thing was improper because it contained music, photos, and videos.
But there were photos that were introduced of the baby, both when it was a happy-go-lucky child as well as when the baby was hospitalized. So why wasn't that cumulative? I understand your point about the music and so forth, but was this entirely verboten from your viewpoint?
Is your question, was it error or was it prejudicial because of lack of cumulativeness, Your Honor?
Well, you're going to the point that he said that he would give it the appropriate weight. And you're indicating, well, that's not really possible because the whole thing was improper. Is that your argument?
Yes. Under the plain language of RCM 1001C and this court's holding in Edwards, because it contained all of those proper improper items, it can't be considered a statement. Definitionally, it cannot be. So the entire thing was error. And so when he said, I will give it the weight it deserves, he should have given it zero weight because of all the impermissible items made it not a statement per the plain language of the rules. And as to cumulativeness...
Before you move on, I guess I'm still confused about how the military judge's statement that he would consider the evidence is an indication of having been so emotionally overtaken by the evidence that he committed error in this case. In other words, there's prejudice in this case. I don't see how you connect the two. I mean, the whole idea with prejudice in a member's case or a jury trial is that these individuals, we don't want them to have their passions inappropriately or improperly inflamed. I don't see there's any evidence here that the military judge, notwithstanding what he said at the trial and what the evidence was, I don't see any indication that his passions were inflamed necessarily. Can you help me out here?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I figured you could.
Your Honor, I would concede that that's one factor this court could consider that he said, I'll consider it, but it's not the end all be all. Another factor this court should consider is that I'm unaware that this court has ever said that military judges are immune from emotion or from persuasion. And in my reply brief, I quoted several judges and justices, some on the Supreme Court, who said there are some cases that will drive you to your knees. And again, this court's precedent has found that military judges alone can commit error, and in several cases that I also quoted, it can be prejudicial. So the fact that this PowerPoint was designed to pack an emotional punch, and it did, it can affect the military judge.
I understand that, but I don't see what in the record shows us that that was the case, other than the fact that he said he would consider it or give it the weight it was due.
Well, Your Honor,
now what happens in a typical case, for instance, when you have the admission of a confession, and the military judge has to consider the confession in a judge alone trial, but later finds the accused not guilty or guilty for that matter. Do you make a complaint that, well, the military judge, even though he didn't admit the confession, considered it, and therefore the conviction should be thrown out?
Your Honor, I would concede there's nothing on the record that says from the military judge that says, wow, the military judge is crying, he was really moved by that, or wow, I'm really going to punish you extra. There's nothing in the record.
That's my problem.
Yes. However, it's the government's burden to show that this wasn't harmlessness, and given the fact of the emotional content, that it provided new ammunition under the Barker factors, its materiality was very high and its quality was very high. So analyzing the Barker factors, it could even sway a military judge, and the government can't prove that it did not. Even if he said, I'm only going to give him an extra day in jail because I was so moved by that PowerPoint, that would be prejudice under this court's precedent under the Barker factors.
I guess the concern...
Thank you, Chief. No, I wanted to get to the second issue before.
If I may, then I just want to follow up on this point. Thank you, Judge Johnson. Here's my concern, though. It seems sometimes when you're talking about this as if you're contrasting having that video, which, as you indicate, tugged at anyone's heartstrings. It was included in the record, compared to nothing. But in fact, what the military judge had was these other photos that also, when you look at those photos as a human being, you're going to have an emotional reaction. Number one, we assume that judges can separate their legal decisions from those emotional reactions. And furthermore, if there already are those emotional reactions out there, just how damaging was this actual video?
Yes. I'll make a few points on the photos. So the first point I'll make is that even according to the victim or the victim representative, the photos that were entered into evidence previously were not probative. She said, starting her victim impact statement, "You've all seen photos, both good and bad, of the victim, but none of them represent the love I have for him and what was taken from me." So even in her mind, the photos that were entered previously were not probative. And that makes sense because Prosecution Exhibit 36, it was a photo of a collage that was on a wall that had several pictures. So it was a photo. So it's a one-page document. And this is where the government is saying, hey, there were 60 photos admitted into evidence. That's not the case. If you look at that one-page document, you can barely even see the images in this case. Now, it is true, Your Honor, there were, by my count, I think 5 or 6 other photos that were large that were entered into evidence. But to contrast the point one more time, the very last photo of the PowerPoint was very much like the presentation in Edwards. It was a picture, a professionally done photo, very clear and crisp, of the victim wrapped in Senior Airman Cunningham's uniform. And to that photo, the victim representative said, "We both deserve justice." And that's very much akin to the emotional, heart-rending image of the father in Edwards bringing the uniform to his face and smelling it. And then trial counsel saying, "He's not around because of the accused." And the implication is the same for this photo. Instead of those sleeves being wrapped around the victim in a loving way, they were instead wrapped around him to hurt the victim and ultimately kill him.
Judge Johnson, I apologize for preempting you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chief. Going to the argument for the second one. My question is with regards to Norwood and the aggravating factors. Is it the appellant's position that previous or prior false statements can never be used in aggravation?
Your Honor, our position is what the Air Force case law laid out. False statements could be used in aggravation if they were factually developed. And that's what the case law from the Air Force Court says. And what's very important here is there was no medical impact from those false statements. And I would point you to the victim testimony in sentencing, or the victim representative. She said, "As soon as I got to the hospital at Sioux Falls, the neurosurgeon came to me and said, 'Your baby will not live through the night. The brain damage is irreparable.'" So any alleged false official statements Senior Airman Cunningham made were not directly related to the offense of murder that he committed. Chief Judge Olson, I see I'm out of time.
Did you have more on the point that Judge Johnson posed to you?
I did, Your Honor.
Then please proceed.
Thank you. The other point is the investigators, right from the beginning, said, "Senior Airman Cunningham, we don't believe you. You're lying to us." And if you watch that video, it was a masterclass in how OSI agents deliver their interrogation techniques. So not only did the investigators never believe him, but the doctors confirmed. And there was a pathologist who testified who said early on they did a brain scan, an eye brain scan, and the results were that is this injury is indicative of non-accidental trauma and abuse. And so there was no detrimental reliance or otherwise where anybody was misled. Therefore, this is violative of RCM 1001.
Okay, thank you.
Anything further?
No, that's...
Anything further? Please.
Back to the first issue. In our precedent, is there a distinction between a military judge knowing, you know, understanding what can be admitted and what not can't be admitted, and what evidence that is admitted for only certain purposes can be used for, and being immune from emotional persuasion?
Is there any precedent?
Yeah. Do you think there's a distinction there between? We have precedents that saying, you know, there are differences. We treat sometimes in certain instances decisions by military judges different from decisions by panels. Is that, in your view, is there a distinction between the military judge being presumed to know the law and therefore knowing what evidence can be admitted, and if some evidence was improperly admitted that they shouldn't consider it, and or is that precedent more based on the fact that we presume military judges are less persuadable by emotion?
Your Honor, I would agree with you that the precedent bears that out, that, hey, military judges know the law, they can discard. The point here is that the victim impact presentation in this case provided so much more new ammunition, so much more ammunition, that notwithstanding the distinctions in the law, there is still error and there's still prejudice in this case analyzing the Barker factors.
Anything else? Thank you, Major Nelson. Major Christie.
Chief Judge Olson, may it please the court, I'm Major Morgan Christie, and along with Colonel Naomi Dennis, I represent the United States. This court should affirm appellant's murder sentence for two reasons. First, the victim's PowerPoint presentation did not substantially influence the judge's sentence because it was largely cumulative with other evidence. And second, appellant waived any claim of improper argument. To frame the first issue, the victim orally delivered her unsworn statement using a PowerPoint as a demonstrative aid to illustrate her words. Although this court's opinion in Edwards disapproved the use of the photo, video, and musical components of the aid, the victim's spoken statements themselves were proper, the written words on the PowerPoint were proper, and her sworn testimony was proper.
What was the point? Right. This is where I struggle with these cases, because, right, a lot of effort goes into creating these PowerPoints. And my understanding is this had become sort of a common practice in the trials. And why was all this effort being, given to creating these PowerPoints, presenting these PowerPoints? Because then the government comes up here, and this is the second time we've had this, and says, don't worry about it. It was totally cumulative. It didn't have any impact. It was completely meaningless. So which is it? I mean, I'm a little bit confused. Why was this a best practice in the trial courts? Why did the victim's mother put all this effort into creating this PowerPoint with animations and music and embedded videos if it was completely cumulative to her proper unsworn statement?
Your Honor, I can't speculate on why exactly the victim chose this mode and medium. But what is important to note is that trial counsel, unlike Edwards, played no role whatsoever in orchestrating, producing, or presenting the PowerPoint statement.
That's relevant to whether or not the government usurped the victim's reasonable right to be heard. Does that have any relevance to the prejudice question?
I think it does, Your Honor, because when looking at the four Barker factors, that would go to the materiality is how that
Once the video's created and presented to the panel or the military judge, what difference does it make who made it? Why is that even relevant?
Well, it's relevant.
Is it less persuasive if the victim made it than if the government made it?
No, Your Honor. But it does go to materiality, and in Harrow, this court held that the materiality of the evidence must be viewed with an eye towards its permissible purpose and how it's used. And the permissible purpose...
But it wasn't permissible, right? It was error. In Edwards, we held, and the CCA recognized below, that the use of the PowerPoint to aid the unsworn victims was error. So it wasn't permissible. What difference does it make who made it?
Because, Your Honor, not all aspects of the PowerPoint unsworn statement were impermissible. So when the judge said, I will give it the weight that it deserves, that was entirely proper because some parts of it were probative and
proper. I don't get it. And it's either admissible or it's not. I mean, you can't. How do we separate the permissible parts from it? The permissible parts were the parts she said in her unsworn statement. It was all fine. The whole video should not have been admitted, right?
Yes, Your Honor, except...
It's not like you can just play the audio from it, even though that would have been problematic because of the music. Like, the whole PowerPoint presentation was a mistake, right? The CCA found that. No one's arguing otherwise here, right? So it didn't have any appropriate weight. There are things in it that if she had included, and I think she repeated things from her unsworn statement in the video, I think we all agree to that, that was all fine. But there's no part of the video that was proper.
I think it's important to distinguish how it was used with Edwards. So unlike Edwards here, trial counsel never once mentioned the PowerPoint in sentencing argument, no less played it at the crescendo of her argument. Trial counsel had no need to play the video because it wasn't the most compelling aspect of the government's case. The egregious nature of the crimes were. And during tearful sworn testimony, which was entirely proper, the victim testified she removed her 5-month-old from life support, held him to her chest so she wouldn't have to watch him die, and sang to him as he took his last breath. That live testimony from a grieving mother was more personal and impactful than a maudlin song and commercial stock photos from strangers paid to pose, especially when the government had already introduced a total of 84 photos of the victim as prosecution exhibits.
Like the government keeps saying that, right? This is the exhibit, right? It's a photo of a collage. I look at this. I can't tell what's going on in any of these photos. Like, are these truly cumulative to showing on a big screen a video that has high-resolution images of all of these photos? Is that truly cumulative? Because it doesn't seem cumulative to me.
It is, Your Honor, because the proper focus when determining prejudice has always been on whether the properly admitted evidence produced substantially the same effect as the improperly admitted evidence. An appellant urges this court to rigidly apply Edwards as a per se rule requiring a finding of prejudice. But Edwards isn't a command that all cases with improperly admitted victim unsworn statements turn out the same way. Edwards did not announce a bright-line rule to determine sentencing prejudice.
And I agree with all that. And what I'm asking is, right, the government wanted a minimum of 20 years, and an appellant wanted something more like 10, and he gets 18. And the question we're faced with is the government needs to persuade us that even though there was this error during sentencing, that something was presented during sentencing that shouldn't have been, it did not have a material impact on the fact that he got 18 instead of something else, instead of 16 or 15. And what is it? I want you to persuade me that I can be rest assured that even though we had this mini trial in sentencing and there was evidence introduced that shouldn't have been, it didn't have a substantial impact on the sentence.
Because objectively, the peak of emotion in this case was when the bereaved mother took the stand and described in agonizing detail the prolonged death of her son over 9 days. And that occurred before the PowerPoint presentation. And a judge, while human, is generally less apt to be swayed by appeals to emotion than a panel. In the 403 context, this court has made clear that the potential for unfair prejudice is substantially less in a judge-alone forum. The judge is presumed to know and follow the law from Bayer that dictates he fashion a sentence not upon blind outrage and visceral anguish, but on cool, calm consideration of the evidence and sentencing principles.
Why would we have any deference for the military judge in this case when he was presented with the fact that it was not a oral or written statement, and he said it was permissible anyway? He made the exact mistake that we all unanimously agreed was a mistake in Edwards. So it doesn't seem that he understood what the rules permitted and what they didn't.
To be fair, Your Honor, at the time, the military judge did not have the benefit of this court's guidance in Edwards. And while
did the language of the rule change?
It did not, Your Honor. But certainly as we see these cases percolate through the appellate courts, the fact that it reached this court's level indicates that there was at least some confusion among the trial judges or the service courts in how to interpret a victim's right to be heard. And while not dispositive, the forum is an important factor because we not only presume judges will be less swayed by appeals to emotion, we expect that of our judges who see these cases all the time. Judges are certainly not unfeeling automatons. They are chosen for their judicial temperament and are uniquely experienced in regulating emotion. An appellant chose to be sentenced by this military judge after seeing him preside fairly over a 9-day trial that included emotional testimony and autopsy photos.
Can I take you back to a point that you brought up before, which is that this case is different from Edwards in the sense that the government had nothing to do with the production of the video in this case. You know, I think in pretty much the history of this court, when there are errors, the government has had to, and they've been preserved, the government has had to prove that they're harmless. This seems to be like one of the first cases in which an error occurred, and if it's attributable to anyone, it would probably be the victim's counsel as opposed to the government. Does that affect who has the burden of persuasion that it was harmless? You mentioned the fact that the government had nothing to do with it, but what is the consequence of that in this case? Do we just treat it the same as Edwards, even though the government had nothing to do with it?
Your Honor, I don't think the standard changes, because certainly the government has an affirmative obligation to ensure that the accused receives meaningful due process and that evidence is admitted that conforms with the rule. But I think what we do with it is analyze it within the framework we already have from Barker. And when we look at the materiality and the quality, victim impact is, of course, just one of many sentencing principles that the military judge is charged with considering. And I think when it goes to quality, it is important to note that rather than a presentation prepared by a trained advocate with a duty to further the government's cause, when the presentation is built by a novice with a duty only to the victim, then that lessens the quality of the evidence. Quality doesn't always equate to production value or pixelation or the quality of cinematography. It's the use of the evidence and how it's created. And here, trial counsel didn't mention it once in sentencing argument or played it.
Suppose in the next case, it's not only the accused who objects, but the prosecution also objects to the victim's use of a video or something that's improper. And then it comes up here. The government still has to prove that the error that it objected to was harmless?
It's an interesting question, Your Honor. I know we haven't fully briefed it. But when I think through the issue, I think that the current framework that we have, certainly the government still has an obligation at representing the sovereign as the United States. I think the judge would have to obviously analyze, and if both sides have an objection to it, the judge is certainly going to take that into consideration. But I don't think since that issue has been fully briefed, we can certainly submit a supplemental brief on that issue, Judge Maggs, if you would like the government's position on that.
Let me ask you a separate question about the Barker factors. I think both sides have expressed some dissatisfaction with applying the Barker factors to sentencing. I mean, they don't really seem to capture the essence of what's wrong here, which is that this evidence allowed consideration of improper matters. And my question is, should we amend the Barker factors, or should we consider other factors, or consider the Barker factors to be non-exclusive? I mean, I think that the difficulty, and I think the defense has made it quite clear, that it's hard to apply them in the sentencing context where improper considerations are raised. You know, it doesn't really fit exactly into materiality or quality.
Your Honor, I don't think that the Barker factors need to be amended or changed, but I do think that each sentencing case obviously rests on the particularities of it. And here, when we look at the forum, that should weigh heavily in deciding the quality and materiality. Because while certainly the judge was faced with a term of years, and it's harder to have that binary prejudice, whether it's guilty or not guilty in findings, I think that the forum is an important factor to weigh within the framework of the four Barker factors. Because sentencing is not a formulistic mathematical endeavor, so determining sentencing prejudice shouldn't be either. It should properly focus on the totality of the circumstances. And here, although not required to do so, the military judge placed a 403 balancing test on the record in admitting the PowerPoint. He articulated his thoughts in real time after watching the video. And at trial, the only aspect defense counsel argued was inflammatory was the PowerPoint animation crumpling up stock photos to signify the victim would never experience certain milestones in his life. And the military judge found that evidence benign. There's nothing in the record to suggest that the military judge let emotion reign over reason. In a judge alone improper argument context in Erickson, the trial counsel in a judge alone sentencing case referred to the accused as an insidious evil and a demon who belonged in hell, and referred to him as Adolf Hitler, Osama bin Laden, and Saddam Hussein. Even in that case, granted that was improper argument, this court looked to, is there anything in the record to show that the military judge was unduly swayed by appeals to emotion during argument or in the sentencing
case? But isn't the basis of the analysis there the fact that the military judge understands what is proper and improper argument and is going to disregard the improper argument rather than that the military judge is somehow immune to improper argument?
Well, certainly the military judge is not immune, Your Honor. Military judges cannot help but feel emotion. But military judges are uniquely charged with being experienced to navigate those emotions, respond to them thoughtfully, and then render a fair and rational decision.
Well, they're presumed to know the law, right? So
they're
presumed to recognize improper arguments as arguments that go over the line and should be disregarded, right? But here, is there anything in the record that you can point to that suggests the military judge understood that portions of this PowerPoint presentation were improper?
No, Your Honor, because certainly he admitted it. But it is...
Right? He described it as proper, right? All of the evidence in the record suggests that he thought all of it was proper. There's not a single word in the record anywhere that indicates he understood any of it was improper, right? So
yes.
We have no basis to say he disregarded any of it.
Yes, Your Honor. But the military judge did say that he would give it the weight it deserves.
Well, what does that mean? Does that indicate that he gave it a lot of weight or that he gave it no weight?
That means that he's going to follow the law. And if there were...
You just told me there's nothing in the record that indicates he understood what the law was.
Well, the judge is presumed to follow the same law that would be applicable for instructions to members. And if this were a member...
But the objection was raised to him on the exact grounds that he should have ruled it as inadmissible. And he said, no, it's fine. He said, I watched it. It's proper. So, like, I know there's not a ton of evidence, but the only evidence in the record suggests he thought it was all fine. Why would we presume otherwise?
Because, Your Honor, we also presume that the military judge knows other law. And the other law that would support this is that if there were members, the military judge would instruct them that the weight to attach to an unsworn rests within the sound discretion of each member. So the members, just like the military judge, can consider the fact that the statement is not under oath. The victim cannot...
But that all applies to a proper unsworn statement. Here we have an improper PowerPoint presentation attached to an unsworn statement. So it should have gotten no weight. Why is he even recognizing that it might deserve some weight at all?
Because, Your Honor, portions of it were permissible, like the written words.
It would have been permissible if they had been included, and some of them were, in the unsworn statement. In this format, they're not permissible at all.
Yes, Your Honor. But it's important because there's a difference between Edwards, which is that the victim orally delivered her victim impact statement using the demonstrative aid as an accompaniment to illustrate her words. So everything that she orally spoke was entirely permissible and conveyed the same themes of loss. And while certainly when you add the song, for instance, that's a maudlin song, but the melancholic melody is not what's heart-wrenching. It's the words that came out of the victim's mouth when she testified under oath.
Can't they both be heart-wrenching?
They can.
I mean, this gets back to my question of why are we doing this? Why are we playing music and showing slideshows and videos unless the purpose of it is to persuade the person who's sentencing the accused that they should get more time instead of less time? Isn't that the whole purpose of the presentation?
Your Honor, I think the purpose is that it's within the victim's statutory right to be heard under Article 16.
Well, an unsworn statement is within the, a proper unsworn statement that's oral or written or both is within the, according to the President, is within the statutory right to be heard. The PowerPoint presentation is not.
Yes, Your Honor. But this is the mode and medium that this victim chose, not only as a victim in her own right, but also assuming the statutory rights of her deceased infant.
But she wasn't allowed to. That's the problem. This is what she chose. The military judge should have stopped her. He didn't, right? The objection was raised. Defense counsel were trying to protect the record, and the military judge failed. So
correct.
Why should we assume that he wasn't persuaded by it?
Because, Your Honor, there's nothing in the record indicating that he was, in fact, persuaded. The government has conceded that there was error.
But there's nothing in the record, then, and it's your burden. You're kind of stuck, right?
No, Your Honor, because when you listen to the audio, which is included in the joint appendix, when the military judge speaks, his voice is not cracking. There are not tears. There are no outward expressions or signs of emotion.
That's a pretty thin read, isn't it?
Your Honor, I don't interpret the audio as a thin read. I interpret it as the military judge has carried on with trial as normal after receiving this evidence.
I see your time has expired. Any further questions?
Can I ask one follow-up question to something Judge Maggs asked? You mentioned earlier that this is sort of a totality of the circumstances, and we're supposed to look at all the evidence and all the sentencing evidence, and this is how the Barker factors work. It sounds an awful lot to me like we're essentially being asked to do sentence assessment. We're being asked, in light of the government's sentencing case, the defendant's, the appellant's sentencing case, and the materiality of the erroneously admitted evidence, did the appellant get the sentence, the proper sentence for the crime he committed? That feels an awful lot like sentence assessment, or sentence appropriateness. Is that essentially what we're being asked to do? And if so, do we even have the authority to do that?
No, Your Honor, you are not asked to be doing that, and this court does not have the authority to do that. The strength of the government's case, which in this case was extremely strong, and the strength of the defense case, which in comparison was weaker, are just the first two Barker factors. This court is not engaging in sentence appropriateness when it analyzes the quality and the materiality and looks to how it was utilized in this case. That's an entirely separate analysis.
Further questions? Any other judges?
No, those last comments just went to the question I was going to raise. So,
thank you. Major Christie?
Thank you.
Major Nelson?
I'd like to pick up where Judge Hardy left off. The government got up here and said, the victim representative testified in agonizing detail. This was an extremely strong case. What the government is implicitly asking this court to do is just say, the strength of our case was really, really strong. Senior Airman Cunningham got 18 years. Therefore, you can be confident he got the right sentence. If that sort of logic prevails, the strength of the government's case will swallow the Barker factors. And I believe that is why, or this court said it's worth noting in Edwards, that the Barker factors are harder to apply in sentencing because it is, in fact, a range. And so under a proper analysis of the factors, even in a military judge setting, sitting alone, if those factors are applied properly, Senior Airman Cunningham still prevails on prejudice. And the government said his case was weaker, but his case was, in fact, very strong. Three witnesses under oath testified to his rehabilitation potential, and one of them was a pastor with kids and grandkids who said, I trust him. And she said she trusted him so much that she would let him live with her. That's very powerful evidence, and that was only the tip of the iceberg. The second thing is, the government said there's no evidence here that the military judge would let emotion reign over reason. Well, unfortunately, the science just does not back that up. The science that was done in the context of trials says when music is overlapped with photos and videos, it heightens the emotion. But most importantly, it not only heightens the emotion, it heightens it to the detriment of rational decision-making capability. And that's the science, and the government cannot get over that. The third point is they said, this PowerPoint presentation, it was built by a novice. Well, that's not exactly true. The musician was a professional artist who wrote professional lyrics, who probably had a band. Also, she used a professional editing program that was built by Microsoft Corporation that could have all those effects. So this was much more than just something built by a novice.
Counsel, just so I'm clear, are you, in that statement with regards to musician, are you saying that this song was written just for the purposes of this video, or did she just take, as government has characterized it, a modeling song and interplayed it into the video?
Yes, the latter, Your Honor.
Okay, all right.
There's no evidence that the song was specifically written. But then that, again, goes to questions that this court has addressed in Tyler and Barker, that the victim impact statement must be personal to the accused. But again, it's just not as easy saying this was built by a novice. And then finally,
Major Nelson, I'm a little concerned about the focus of your argument on the sentencing evidence. Now, I believe, and I kind of know from my own experience, that the sentencing authority is required to review all the evidence in the case. And in this case, the military judge would have been required, and undoubtedly did, consider the very, I don't want to say gruesome, but certainly critical and serious nature of the crime in this case that he heard on the merits as well. So it isn't just what's presented at the sentencing hearing, is it?
Chief Judge Olson, I see my time.
Please proceed.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. We don't argue with that. However, the court has articulated there's a greater likelihood of prejudice when there's new ammunition that's introduced. And here, there was plenty of ammunition. This case was a tinderbox. And instead of having the guardrails high, this PowerPoint impermissibly stoked the emotions as well as those improper arguments by trial counsel.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you. Major Nelson.
Thank you.
The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until further order of the court.
Court stands adjourned until further order of the court.